All right, well, we didn't quite finish up last week. That is, when I got home thinking about it, I didn't quite finish up last week. And I'm going to try one more time to be clear about something, and it'll probably fail again. But this whole idea of liberalism, what it is a very hard concept to grasp. And I thought it might be a good test to go out into some places where liberalism is taught into the churches. And then you come back and tell me, what it was that you saw different. And I'm not sure it would work. I don't know. But we're going to try one more time to explain liberalism, because it certainly is the undercoat of the painting that we're trying to erect for you. Liberalism is still around. It is, as you might say, dead and alive at the same time. So we'll explain that a little bit, because that's what I didn't tell you last week when I came home. I thought I didn't explain to you when I said liberalism is dead and yet it lives. How does that work? So we're going to talk about evangelicals. We're actually following along the evangelical route here on the bottom. It's probably too small for you to see. Is this piece of information on the chart. And what we have in the first part is pretty well unified here. And then we hit about 1850, and then it divides and will never come back together again. So Christianity, as it was accepted or understood in up till 1850, let's say, was considered pretty much a uniform mass of thinking. There were differences in it. And sometimes you're really amazed how that different pastors from different churches would exchange pulpits regardless of their theology. And sometimes they took on these pulpits permanently, even though you might have a Presbyterian being a Baptist pulpit, or a congregational pastor being in a Reformed pulpit and so forth. So that sort of indicates that there really wasn't that much difference in the theology that they can make these changes. Second thing about it, these churches were not necessarily doctrinally oriented. I didn't get a chance to do that this week, but I got to do it next week for you, is when Moody hears a brethren, Plymouth Brethren guy teach the Bible. He's teaching John 3:16. I'll do this again next week for you, so bear with me. You'll hear it twice. I wasn't going to do it tonight, but he teaches John 3:16. And he, first of all, didn't even know they were going to let him in the pulpit because he didn't know anything about him. So he let him in the pulpit, and he really did a good job. John 3:16. So there was opportunities for him to come back. So they asked him to stay for the next night, and he preached again on his text. He said, open your Bibles to, or he didn't probably say open your Bibles, but my text tonight is John 3:16. And he came back for the third night, and he said, well, my text tonight is John 3:16. And so he went a whole week doing that. And the thing that was so remarkable is that at this point is where Moody decides that he's got to change his way of teaching. Surprise of surprise is that way of teaching that this gentleman, I forget his name right now, who was a Plymouth Brethren from England, was teaching was what's called readings or Bible readings. We know the word today as expository preaching. Because until then, expository preaching, where you look at the Bible verse and take it apart and explain what it says, was unheard of. In fact, there was a lot of criticism about that kind of preaching because it really wasn't a sermon. And so some felt it would fail. But Moody saw what was happening in it. It revitalized his preaching when he saw him do that. So I thought it was really interesting that we have this idea, and this is true of all our stuff here. We have an idea that Christianity was the way we have experienced it in our lifetime. And that's the way it's always been. And that is so far from the truth. There are certain things that are alike, but in style and so forth, there's a lot of difference. We sometimes, admire Spurgeon in his preaching, but he was not an expositor. He got him preached the sermon, an idea, and then developed the idea. And that's different than taking a Bible verse and explaining it. And we wonder, how in the world could you preach seven times on John 3:16? Well, some of you that are teachers probably can figure out, yeah, I think I could do that. So you take the Bible verse apart and make it talk, and all of a sudden the Bible becomes alive and active, and like it says in Hebrews, like a sharp two-edged sword. So anyway, it's interesting that that experience came from a Darby descendant, and Moody picked up on it. So that's not even in the lesson. I'm already 5 minutes into it. So the evangelicals, it's a period of time we're going to follow the evangelicals mostly, and we'll talk about behind the scene is the unevangelicals, and we're probably pretty much finished that up. That's how I intend to just continue to fill that out, because it's the evangelicals that really where the action is. The non-evangelicals, the mainline denominations, are just dying and dying and dying and dying and making all kinds of effort to stay alive. So by the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, you pretty well have the mainline denominations have become irrelevant, and they are writing books now. Why are the evangelicals winning? You have that kind of thought, but you wouldn't think of that 50 years ago because it wasn't evident where this was going. So we're going to follow the evangelical trail. So I call America on training wheels because they're a new nation. The opening weeks of our session, we've had two now. This is number three. We noticed the tremendous importance of the 19th century, and that's 1800s. We could hardly say these are changes because the nation has not been established long enough to have changes in it. So it's kind of more like the first appearances in New America, and where we have, in a first time ever in the history of mankind, something being done that hadn't been done before, even under Judaism. We have, for the first time, the first appearances in New America, the ideals of freedom, liberty, personal responsibility, innovation, and progress. All of these are Christian ideals. We don't recognize them as Christian ideals. We look at them as just what's that's normal. But you go to where Christianity has not influenced culture, these don't exist. Even in Judaism, they're under the law. Boy, that wasn't restrictive. So these are Christian ideals that have, for the first time in human history, an opportunity to explode, and they exploded. With this newfound liberty, the 1800s, in which to experiment, there was virtually no limit to the possibilities that the human spirit could dream up. There were no laws stopping you. In fact, in the West, there was no law. What was it called? The law of the West was the cult. That was the law. And so there was no law to restrict anybody. There were no taxes, you know, and what you earned and what you raised, you kept, unless somebody stole it from you, and you had figured out a way to keep that. So we have religious experimentation that's going on at this time, too, because it was not exempt from innovation. Even religion was not exempt. There were no national church to establish and accept a theology. So strange religions flourished. So out of this time, we have scientific discoveries that were now changing dramatically, that people were open to updating their old-time religion. With the old-time religion, because the old-time religion had made a few mistakes in their observation of nature, you know, thought the sun was in the wrong place or the earth was in the middle of the universe, all that kind of stuff. So they made some mistakes. So they found out that put the religious dogma into a category of doubtful. So what their pastors or priests were saying about nature found out to be wasn't right always or often wrong. So like a normal person says, well, if they're wrong about that, and that's a religious issue, even the orientation of the sun and the moon and all that stuff, so maybe he's also wrong about other things that speak to our spiritual life. So ergo, if religion was wrong in some way, why is it not wrong in other ways? Maybe it's wrong in all ways. So while the church theologians were making pronouncements that touched on science, and they were not scientists, they'd made mistakes and could not restrain the speculations of the false scientists because their credibility was going down. And since true science had corrected some things, now I'm talking true science, the speculations of the false science, I call them science philosophers, were now taken as pure gold. You know, if a scientist said something, and even if it was wrong, it was right. I mean, no one could prove him wrong. So these philosopher sciences, whatever they said, were taken as gold. So strongly did these false scientists present their case that even the theologians caved into their speculations of origins and the age of the earth. And by this time, we're adding billions to the earth and millions to the age of man. Most devastating was that there was no sustainable voice to defend the Bible's pronouncement of origins. No one was speaking up for the Bible. Well, to right this wrong, now we come into our day, at least mine, it was not until 1959, just before our oldest daughter was born. See, I got this all figured out, so it relates to me because I can remember that. Until 1959, say 200 years later, that the Lord raised up a challenge to speculative science in the person of John Whitcomb, which some of you have heard him speak here, and Henry Morris, who's been gone to the Lord for quite some time, in their book called The Genesis Flood. That was a challenge to speculative science. A scientific challenge, not a biblical challenge, but a scientific challenge to create evolution. But in the first half of the 20th centuries, Christianity made no defense of biblical pronouncements that touched on the area of origins and the ages of the world. They just couldn't touch it. So when they said the earth is old and millions of years old, as we have said before, if you guys are still listening to Vernon J. McGee, he's got a gap theory in his Genesis. Even today, when they play it on the radio, you will hear him teach that. They don't edit his tapes anymore, I don't think. So he was a gap thigh. So was Schofield, whose Schofield Bible we'll talk about later, and all the other notables in the turn of the century were all gapish, or they had day-age period, so they built in all kinds of time into the early verses of Genesis. So there's no one defending the Bible during these 150 years when this is being challenged, except, as I mentioned last week, the Seventh-day Adventists never bought into the Kool-Aid. They stuck with the Bible no matter what the scientists said, false science said, and they end up being the right ones. So it is a tragedy that 200 years is what I always think about, and the loss, 200 years was lost to the study of true science while the evolutionists honed their skills arguing their case. They were practicing and got really good at it, and in the meantime, we were just giving in to them. Without any defense from the theologian scientists like Whitcomb and Morris, there was an unrestrained and unrelenting attack on the old-fashioned religion. Last week, we talked about Friedrich Schleiermacher. He gave cover to these renegades by suggesting that in true Christianity, it is not the doctrines that define it, but it is the product that Christianity produces, which is a feeling. Now, here's where I lose touch with reality, their reality. So it's not Christianity built on doctrines that define Christianity, but it is the product of Christianity that defines Christianity, which is a feeling, which are achievable without the heavy lifting of doctrinal reasoning. You'd have to think through the doctrines. In fact, the doctrines condemn us, and therefore I'm really depressed, and I'm not happy at all, and if I get rid of those doctrines, then I'd be happy and not depressed. I think that's how it works. So we have a hard time quantifying, measuring this feeling aspect, that expectation. How is it that we understand it? But eventually we end up with some kind of experience. Obviously, that experience must be a satisfying experience. You can't have a Christian experience that's bad. So it's got to be a satisfying experience. But what experience? So maybe we can borrow, as Schleiermacher did, from the experience that is produced by good doctrine about Christ at the core and so forth, such as things that we enjoy as Christians, that there's peace, there's contentment, there's happiness, there's purpose, fulfillment, joy, and did I use the word forgiveness in here? I didn't, even I could have. These are the things that give us joy and happiness because we know our sins are forgiven. So he wants that idea of joy and capture that and say, that's Christianity, and ignore how we got there. So the idea caught on that the Christian experience is not rooted in doctrines. That's Schleiermacher. A real experiential Christianity will emerge without these nasty doctrines. So the Christian experience is possible without offensive doctrines of sin, death, and judgment, which are all depressing. The unbeliever, We don't need the divinity of Christ if we don't need to have anybody saved. The question of origins and age of the earth, all that is not in question anymore. So all these Christian doctrines can be jettisoned because all we need to do is be against supernatural things. If we're against supernatural things, God hasn't interfered and we're safe. And we're all really, really happy. Since Schleiermacher was the voice of this idea, he is called the father of liberal theology, or an old term, father of modernism. Somebody talked to me last week about their dad talking about modernism. And we don't hear it too much today because, well, it's not used. Liberalism is the word. But it used to be modernism was the word well talked about. So liberal, it's called liberal because the theology of it is liberating. I put on the board here, the liberal is loose. I mean, there's no constraint to it. Whereas literal is tight. And I talk in my Sunday morning class about a contract. The Bible is a contract. It's a tight contract. It's their tight concept that God says this and this is what he's going to do. And he told us ahead of time what he's going to do and he's going to perform it. It says in Isaiah, this is what he's going to do. There's no doubt about it. So we look at literal and that's tight. It's not loose. So liberal because the theology is liberating for them. Liberating of Christianity, of dead dogma, dead theology, leaving a truthful, offenseless Christianity, full of meaningful experiences, or simply a feeling of goodness. Again, I don't relate to this, and I guess if I do, I'd probably have drunk the Kool-Aid. Well, anyway, last week, this is one thing I want to clarify. Last week I mentioned that liberalism is dead, yet the quest for religious experience continues today, and I'd say even almost accelerating with the emerging church, called the postmodern church. Religious feelings, noted that there are manipulations of mysticism being promoted in the postmodern church. We have candles, incense, darkness, almost seance-type settings to elicit some kind of experience. So how can liberalism be dead and yet alive in the postmodern church? And this is what I failed to explain. Here's my attempt. A comparison. When a language is dead, it does not mean that it is lost or forgotten. And it's taken off all the libraries. That is not what it means. This means that no one is using it as a useful means of communication. Some languages are dead because no one uses them. Okay, now Hebrew is such a language of Zionism, the state of Israel's desire to start a state of Israel, when Hebrew was again taught, and now is spoken language as the official language of the state of Israel. Now it's not a dead language anymore. Now it's a live language because it is used. So when we say that liberalism is dead yet being practiced, it means that the philosophy is no longer attracting any scholarly defense of it, and that's the key. No one's writing in its defense anymore. People have stopped writing about the value of it. No supporting articles in theological journals that promote the value of liberalism. That is not happening anymore. Therefore, silence in the schools and in the press. Liberalism dead, yet it lives without a present defense. It's kind of say, well, who keeps this going? I don't know. I think it's the other guy I call the enemy. Somehow this keeps on going because you have to have some kind of religion, and they haven't, you know, they've tried to replace it with something else, but liberalism is dead, but it still lives on in the way people think of things. Of course, this is a battle for the souls of men, one at a time. It matters little that liberalism is dead, only that heresy of it continues to be practiced. So as long as the soul seeks for a satisfying experience, there's little attention afforded to doctrines that are needed for eternal life. So the enemy's mission is accomplished, even though liberalism is dead. Now we're jumping ahead about 100 years here, 50 years. Here, Emerson Fosdick, yeah, I don't have his full name up there. But he only died in 69, the year Gill came. So, you know, it's not like he's that far back. So he's kind of the last of the real good liberals that anybody listened to, and he preached the message, will the fundamentalists win? We'll talk about that later. Now, I don't understand this phrase. Evangelical liberals, that's already an oxymoron. There aren't evangelical liberals, but that's how they use them. He wants to be considered evangelical. Evangelical liberals assume that Christianity began in a direct religious experience of God. We could talk about that, I guess. An extract religious experience of God. I don't know whether I want to, you know, I don't, you're not the wrong, you're the wrong group to ask, I know. But how would you find someone that had a religious experience of God? And not with God, it says of God. That's the right preposition here. All right, so that's what he would say. Now, he's the one that sort of was opposite of William Jennings Bryan in that era, 1925, the Scopes Monkey Trial. So he's the liberal voice, most popular of the liberal voice. So he says evangelical liberals assume that Christianity began in a direct religious experience of God. Assumed that that's their position. So experience produced doctrine. So you have, I guess, a collective experience of some sort, and out of that we have some truth. I don't follow this. This is not, and it's not in reverse. We always start from doctrine goes to the right experience. They start with the experience and move back and build a doctrine of. That's how we say Christianity was built. I don't know if there's any evidence for it, but I guess you can say it. So the Reverend Harry Emerson Fosdick, longtime pastor of New York Riverside Church, and probably the most famous, was wont to say that Christian experience bore the same relation to theology as the enjoyment of a flower did to science of botany. Now, you make a connection between a flower and the science of botany. It's hard, but somehow he does it in his mind. So he goes on to say, or they go on to say, this is actually from the National Humanistic Centers. It's a school organization. He writes about liberalism. These individuals insisted that the historic focus upon individual salvation reflected a highly selective, now get this, highly selective, if not downright immoral, reading of the Bible. So if you read the Bible and it is down and it speaks to you personally, that's an immoral rendering of the scriptures. In this view, the larger meaning of Hebrew scriptures called the structure, usually meant legislative, judicial, the structural intervention in society in order to rebalance staggering disparity of wealth, inhumane working conditions, and exploitation of children in factories, and the list could go on, I'm sure. But you see, we're moving away from individuals to a group. It's highly immoral to read the Bible that is specifically addressed to the individual. Another word for this? Socialism? Individual salvation reflected a highly selective, if not downright immoral. Notice how far liberalism has come then and today. Recently, within my last breath almost, recently in the last week, someone said that opposing abortion is really an unchristian thing. Opposing abortion is an unchristian thing. And I think of Isaiah chapter 5. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet, sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. And there's more. So looking deeper, we have yet to answer one more question about liberalism and its sought for product, feelings. Feeling good about oneself. We could say having a satisfied mind. There was a song years ago that talked about a satisfied mind. I guess we're talking about it that way. The opposite of guilt, the opposite of despair, the opposite of depression, the opposite of condemnation, and the opposite of judgment. I guess if you all of a sudden thought you were going to hell, because that's what the doctrine said, and all of a sudden you said, no, that's not true, you can live any way you want to, I would say I'd be happy. And maybe that's the feeling. This release from these doctrines is really a happy thing, or makes one feel good. So whenever I say Ed, that's me. My name is Ed, but I'm the editor. Experience the aroma without the flower. Liberalism is having the aroma of the flower, but without the flower, and if at best you get a cheap dime store version of perfume. Is that good enough? Liberalism was reduced to a morality based on the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, and I have noticed this many times. A person that is in liberal church basically hears Sermon on the Mount messages every Sunday because there aren't any other messages that were worth preaching. So why are those passages so important to them? Well, they don't preach them for what they really say. They preach them for what they want out of them. So this is how they read Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount. It starts off, say, blessed are the poor, and that means, you know, dollar poor. Blessed are the sad people for the persecution that Christians bring on them or whatever. Blessed are those that are hungry. Blessed are those that are non-judgmental. Blessed are those morally pure. I'm wondering where they are. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the underdogs. Blessed are those that are trampled on, and blessed are the victims. That's how they read this. And it has nothing to do with what the passage teaches. Nothing at all. So when I'm in Israel and I teach Sermon on the Mount at the place where the Sermon on the Mount was given, I have the joy of explaining to our group what it really says, and I don't have time to go through that. So what would Jesus do is as deep as the theology they can go in moralism. And you've seen the rest. And what would Jesus do? And I know the kids wear them without thinking, but that's as deep as their theology can go, and that's the deepest they need to go, because whatever Jesus would do, they would do in a moral sense, except that they can't do what Jesus did. They don't notice that. So a moral religion renders a feeling of goodness when it's chosen morals are practiced. You know, someone doesn't give you the morals that you are to practice. You choose your own. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to practice those that I can do. So I get good feeling when I do the morals that I choose, especially then to really show how moral I am when I deny myself of something good. So in a sense, sacrifice of the self is the highest ideal. Now, I'm starting to see connections between the sacrifice of Christ, which they reject, and if I sacrifice parts of me, that's acceptable. All right? So the sacrifice of self is the highest ideal. A community practicing an accepted morality, we all agree what that is. Back in the days of slavery, it was the accepted immoral act. The community practicing an accepted morality that becomes the basis for the group salvation. So we all do the same thing. We are saved together because we're all supporting the same morality. Thus, in mutual sacrifice, he saves himself. And I just say, see the Lenten ideas. You know, when you do Lent, our church never did Lent, but if you did Lent, you always gave up something that you thought was good, right? You never gave up something that was bad. So in this, you see, I give up something that myself really wanted, but for a moral good, I gave it up. And see, there is where my sacrifice is. There is my goodness. There is my feeling. But we call it simply, it's works. It's works. But it's really a works of self-sacrifice. So in this whole scenario, the individual is missing in this social group. So what do you do with these impulses of moralism that I get as a liberal person? What do I do with these impulses of moralism? I fix them on others. That's what I do. You should. And the social ills, you should. We saw this run out at the Northern Christians in the Civil War against the immoral practice of slavery. And I'm not going to get into the issue of slavery here. There's plenty to say about that. But the way it was used was to prepare the people for the coming of Christ. In order to do that, we've got to kill 600,000 people. Then the Lord can come. Now, that is immoral, if you ask me. So the group social gospel fits here. They have decided. They have decided what's right. In that case, the Civil War. It's worth the Civil War. Once the moralists saw that they could affect society, they began to fix more of it. They got rid of slavery. Now, what else can we do? So next was the evil of alcohol. The next was the evil of gambling, necessity of women to vote. Another issue we could discuss. Evil child labor, the evil prostitutions. And we say that probably is evil. But to get rid of it in the way they got rid of it, by the moralism and other things, was an evidence of their newfound religion. So once the morality is detached from the Bible, morality has lost the only legs to stand on. If subjective feelings are the end of Christianity, no one is able to judge right and wrong. Therefore, all conduct must be accepted. And the Ten Commandments or the law comes from the Bible, none of those laws or the principles from them can be binding. So whether it's drugs or sex or murder or stealing or lying, all are acceptable if the end result produces a good feeling. Now, can you live in that kind of society if you were to think about it? Well, this may be good thinking when you're high on marijuana, not you, but somebody. It is less than worthless in an orderly society, and it is an annihilation of it. I'm putting a bigger type for you to see. Can you see that better? I mean, it's better for me. Uh-huh. It's better? Well, just tell me that whether it's true or not. God, I feel better. You got it. You got it. No, don't worry about the reality. If you just make me feel better, you'll do your moral job. Okay. We have completed the canvas of our picture upon the reflections of life in the age of the evangelicals. We're going to start with Jonathan Edwards. The person starting with Jonathan Edwards in 1700, let's say middle of 1700, he dies, young man. He is the end of the Puritans, kind of, and he's also the beginning of the evangelicals. So this goes back to our beginning of our study last year, last October. So the person with Jonathan Edwards shifted to evangelicals. We have a shift from a God-sovereign salvation to a man-centered salvation. God chooses or man chooses. That's Calvinism, Arminianism. And we have our last layer, this new nation of the United States, who is for the first time is actually have the opportunity to practice a Christianity unfettered by, and it's practiced by and large by unbelievers, but the values of Christianity are imposed or accepted by our Constitution of the United States. So we have a new nation, United States, an unprecedented freedom of uncluttered, unfettered Christianity, and it's in this place, of all places, where liberalism takes root. Well, one reason is they had the freedom to do it, okay? Now, this is, I don't do this often, but I enjoyed this series of 8 documentaries produced by AMC. I just finished last night. It's on Amazon Prime for free. And it's a backdrop of American culture, and it takes you clear out to about 1900. And it deals with these outlaws like Jesse James and Billy the Kid and Wyatt Earp and the Indians, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and all that kind of stuff. And how they fit into what they were doing, and if it's a good background for our study, and it's only the last from Civil War on, and it ends up at the end of the 1800s that now the West is settled and we go on with America as we know it. So I thought you might enjoy that. It's just called The American West if you have interest in it. So liberalism challenges the old-time religion, causing a bifurcation, a separation of the Christian stream, which I showed you this picture before, and my arrow, blue arrow, shows that. Well, liberalism takes off with the bait, thinking about a fish striking the bait. Well, liberalism takes off with the bait offered by Schleiermacher. There is, at the same time in Ireland, a connection being made to the seminal, the first error of the church fathers that will challenge liberalism, yes, and capture the hearts of many Americans, especially in the 20th century. The first era of the church, if you don't know this, remember this, the early seminal era of the church fathers was that they disenfranchised the Jews, an action unauthorized by God, but made possible by the animus, the hatred the church fathers had for the Jewish people, and they had it. You might say they were justified. It doesn't matter. They had it. The connection between the era of the church fathers and liberalism is a short one. Watch this. If the Bible can be read to get rid of the offensive Jewish promises, that one thing, while still maintaining Christianity, why not disregard all the offensive doctrines? And that's exactly what liberalism does. And so again, we have the Christian fathers, I call them the juveniles, showing the liberals how to do this. They're just good students. If you get rid of the Jewish promises that you don't like, it will get rid of the promises we don't like the death of Christ, the deity of Christ, the sinfulness of man. Get rid of all those things. We don't like those things. You can set them aside, set aside the Jewish promise. Why can't you set aside all the other offensive ones as well? And they do. But as it is with the Lord, he always puts the brakes on. Just when it looks like the other side or the wrong side is going to win, he throws in a monkey wrench. But in 1840, J.N. Darby in Ireland turned the doctrine of the Jews back to the Bible, returned the doctrine of the Jews back to the Bible by a consistent literalism. Now, I don't know if I'm going to do this here or not, but this, I'm not sure I did this or not. I probably did it somewhere. Anyway, this consistent literalism is a new thing. Everybody's reading the Bible allegorically. And when John Nelson Darby starts, no, you can't do that. The Bible says this is Israel, and these are the promises God made to Abraham, and they're still in force, and this is the land he gave him, and he never took them back. That's a consistent literalism. They weren't doing the Bible that way. And that's why Darby is so important. So he found out by consistent literalism that Gil always talks about hermeneutics. That's a good word. That's what I'm talking about here, the hermeneutics. It's a consistent literalism. And the correction is the church is not New Israel, and we've heard that all along. The Puritans thought America was the New Israel. The land is the New Israel, and we're going to live by the new land and the new rules and the old rules from the Old Testament coming to the new land, and therefore we got to kill heretics, and they hung Mary Dyer. All makes sense. So the church is not New Israel. It is a new thing. With this new or old weapon of consistent literalism, the defenders of the Bible had the tools with which to defend against those who said feelings, not doctrines, was the base, not doctrine was the base of Christianity. Therefore, any reexamination or reaffirmation of the Christian faith and its doctrines began in the 1840s. You know, you know what you believe when someone challenges what you believe, right? You've probably experienced that. Well, somebody asked me about the Trinity. You know, I just couldn't explain it very well. What do you do next? Get your book out and get some help out. How can I explain this better? All right? So when Christianity was challenged in its literalness, which Darby brought up, it said the Israel is a literal nation and the promises have not been fulfilled, that is challenged. Now we got to go back and say, are we really right about this? So this new weapon, consistent literalism, defenders of the Bible had a tool with which to defend those who said feelings, not doctrines, was the basis of Christianity. Therefore, a reexamination, reaffirmation of Christian faith, literal Christian faith, built on doctrine, began in the 1840s. Now, while the question of authority of the written word has now been adjudicated, I mean argued, been somewhat settled, we keep what used to be infallible, now it's inerrant, so there's no new words, we're sort of stuck with that word now. While the question of authority of the written word has now been argued to an end, in Christian literature, especially since the 1970s with Moody Fuller Seminary, and we'll talk about that sometime when we get to it, the doctrines of how to read the Bible, literally or allegorically, was never set forth before 1850. See, that's what I'm thinking. You say, well, it's always been the way we think. No, it's not always been the way we think. So this is where things changed. And from 1850 on, the literalism tightens up the theology. So the formation of this theology, the literalism, in association with the growth of the millenarian, the thousand-year kingdom movement, actually then determined the character of fundamentalism. That's a word we'll use later on about 1900. It's not used yet. But we're going to go back to the fundamentals. These guys in 1840 started to study the Bible against it. We got to go back to the fundamentals of this faith. In fact, we even have a class in our church right now by Jeff, right? The fundamentals of the faith. And the idea is you go to the basic ideas taught by the Bible for new believers or old believers, whoever. So heretics are born out of allegory. While literalism was being recovered, while literalism was being recovered, those who did not adopt the solution, the literalism, to the doctrinal questions, continued to chase wild ideas. So out of this 1840 period, well, some of them were getting better, some were getting worse. In the following decades, the cults and the near-cult Christian sects were formed. Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, Unitarianism, Mormons, all those we name are still surviving today, come out of this period. Remember, they had the freedom to do that. There was no law they couldn't do it, which was right. Freedom to be wrong. So with this background in mind, move into the next phase of American Christianity. Again, just as liberalism is taking root in 1837, a wonderful year, a boy is born in Northfield, Massachusetts that will be the most effective advocate for Christianity in the 19th century. It may be an error to give Dwight Lyman Moody the credit for single-handedly saving Christianity, but one is hard-pressed to find another man who had more influence or did more to establish evangelical Christianity in America than the businessman turned evangelist than Dwight L. Moody. And I am going to run out of time, so you're going to have to stick with me or I'm going to have to break off. Okay, remember Puritans. We began our series October 2017, a year ago, with the coming of the Puritans to America, started in 1630, 10 years after the Pilgrims came. Both Moody's ancestral parents were part of the early immigrations. The Holtons on the mother's side in 1630, the first wave. John Moody, his John Moody's paternal side in 1633. Again, early Puritan comers. Moody's parents, Betsy Holton, and if you look on the map, and I did, Google map, and I see that there are streets named Holton and streets named Moody, because these lived there for many years, about 200 years. So the Moody's parents, Betsy Holton and Edwin Moody, were married, and these are the parents of Dwight. Their ancestors were some of the first who settled in Northfield, Massachusetts, now living there for over 200 years, and that's why the names of these families are on the streets. And it's here that Dwight was born. So when you think of them named the street after Moody, I'm not sure it could well have been named after the ancestral name. Ah, look at that, a map. Now, what's interesting about this map is that Jonathan Edwards ministered here at Northampton. Hadley, where we stayed night, if you guys were on our trip, was right here. And up here is Northfield. See, is it Vermont up there? You know your maps? Above is Vermont, truck driver. That's where we are. Okay, so above it, within 10 miles of the border. And that camp is still there. And it's, all right, so it's called whatever it's called. And you back up a little bit here, which is this picture. This is a Google pedestrian map. And to the right, you drive into the lane that takes you up to, which is right behind those trees, is Moody's birthplace house. Okay, which is on the map here. So you see, if you could see underneath here, this is Moody's Road, and somewhere down lower is Holton. All right, it's just interesting that these names appear on these streets. So now, Jonathan Edwards is 200 years later, or earlier, I'm sorry, than Moody, but we're talking about the same area. And I'm always impressed when you go up to Massachusetts area how much Christianity there was up there. And if you ever want to do some studies, that's a great place to go for vacation and get something out of it rather than just look at trees. All right, so there you have the picture of his birth house, and you have the picture of the tombstones. His birth house is here, and his tombs, their tombs are here, all right? And so this is the road that I was standing on, the picture was, and this is the driveway up to the house, I think, and I wasn't terribly sure about that, and I was spending too much time on this. I said, I have a class to teach tonight, I got to get going. So I might have made a mistake, but that's generally how it works. And so what you see here is actually the camp for the boys. There's also a girls' school that was actually started first. And this camp, by the way, is still available, and it's been remodeled and been updated. I'll probably say this again later on, by the people that own Hobby Lobby. They have reconditioned all these buildings, put new roofs on them. The outside look absolutely gorgeous. They're just waiting for somebody to take it and use it for a Christian ministry. You guys got any ideas? It's millions of dollars worth of stuff. Of course, you got millions of dollars to run it, too, you know, whatever it is. So anyway, it's sitting there, as far as I know, without it being used. All right, so this is Moody's birthplace. We were there in the fall. The trees, the foliage was great. And that building obviously looks old because there's been many portions been added to it. So anyway, there is official recognition of the place. And across the street to our back, the first picture is a cemetery where the Moody family, you go into the cemetery, see a lot of Moody, you know, tombstones buried there. Even his own children were born, built, buried there. And this is the burial tombstones of the couple. And there's a guy that was on this. His name was Irvine, I think it was. He was on our tour with Mr. Cobar. He said he was the expert on Jonathan Edwards. And he stood there and he started singing the 99, the sheep that was lost, without any instrumentation, just stand up, and he belted that out of there, and you could hear him for a mile. And I said, why don't you tell me you're going to sing that? I recorded that. then I'd have to put you to it to listen to it. But I mean, he was in his 75, you know, and he had a voice that boomed. Anyway, I'm thinking about that all the time. He just stood there and just started singing this song, the 99. And that would be a moody song, you know, because he was an evangelist. Okay, now, we will not make our consideration of Moody a biography. That's just too much. But we will give you some highlights of this remarkable life, keeping our eye on the contribution to the evangelical movement of his day and the residual carryover to the 20th century. Even my daughter went to Moody Bible Institute in 19. What year did she graduate? Okay, so Dwight, we'll do some of this. I'll have to stop somewhere. Dwight Moody was born a sinner. Like all the rest of humanity, he was a sinner like all the rest. His father, a worker as a mason, died when Moody was about 4 years old, after which posthumously twins were born. So the mother had her hands full. Challenge to the mother was formidable. Having wood to burn became a godsend when the children were told to stay in bed until school time just to stay warm. Moody, never a true rebel, he was a joker but not a rebel, showed his sensitivity to the work of God even in his pre-conversion years at home. His mother, disciplinarian, saw to it that the children were in Sabbath Unitarian Church school, the place where Moody said he first found Christ. Now, don't run away with that statement. His mother lived to the age 90, having faithfully ruled her household of seven, and I have read up to eight because I don't know where those eight came from. Well, it looks like there were six plus two, so it'd be eight. No. Moody was the sixth, so there'd be two more, it'd be eight. So it'd have to be eight. And it looks to me like, just my cursory reading of the story, that his mother probably became saved later in his ministry. Now remember, I said she came from a Unitarian church, all right? I'm going to explain a little bit about that, either today or next time. But the fact that she did not want him to go into the ministry, and that at one of his ministry events where he preached, there was a response to faith and she stood up as they would for that. So it sort of makes me think that she maybe got saved later in life, which would be fine, as long as you get saved, so to speak. Of course, better earlier is better. Back to Moody. After working odd jobs on farms as a printer, Moody bore a restlessness that only a city that offered opportunity could satisfy. So at age 16, even 14 with $5 in his pocket, and you take that time a factor of maybe 20, so maybe he has $100 in his pocket, given to him by his brother, he set out for Boston, and he walked or rode carriages or hitchhiked his way 100 miles. Now, you read the story about his mother, not all happy about all this. It may seem uncharacteristic when we bubble wrap our children and protect them from every small adversity. This young guy just takes off. And he did that. He hitched a ride to his grandma's house, not hitched a ride, drove the carriage with 5 cents, which took 10 cents to get on. But he had 5 cents. He talked to the carriage driver to take him anyway. So he had that ability to talk people into doing things they ordinarily wouldn't do. And then on the way back, he didn't have any more money. He knew that, so he picked some flowers and gave them to the driver, and they put them on the top. So, you know, he was resourceful. So here we have Moody on his first project in Boston. But Moody had already shown his ability to move against the goads of life. Using his innovation and innovative mind, he saw possibilities once the Boston journey was undertaken. With Moody on his own in Boston, the quick employment he sought did not materialize. You know, every guy goes to the city, so I'll have a job tomorrow morning, you know, big paying job, retirement, all that kind of stuff. Well, he had two uncles in the shoe business, but they were too proud. He was too proud to ask them for a job at first. An uncle, aware of Moody's ambition, allowed him to run out of mental and financial resources. Then his uncle said that he didn't want Moody because Moody would want to run the place. A lesson of humility was appropriate. Yet Moody would not ask for work. Finally, Holden, uncle, his mother's brother, said Moody could work for him, but he'd have to do it his way, the way he wanted it done. And he said to Moody, you have until Monday to think it over. And by the way, you'll have to go to Sunday school as well. And Moody said, well, I don't have till Monday, I'll promise now. So Moody took the job and began his career in shoes. So Moody learned his humility lesson well, became a great asset to the shoe store. His innovation and enthusiasm for marketing made uninterested folks willing to buy shoes. Moody, in compliance with his uncle's request, attended the Mount Vernon Congregational Church, where the well-known Dr. Edward Couric, a Presbyterian in a congregational church, see, get that, was the pastor. His Bible class teacher was Edward Kimball. But Moody, as a student in the class, was Bible illiterate, even not knowing that John, the gospel, is in the New Testament. We did not mention that before. I didn't. At the time of Moody's father's death, the Unitarian Church pastor was a helpful resource to the family. It seems that it may have been the family church. Their only Bible was a family-sized one, seldom open due to its ponderousness. So Moody was illiterate. Now, we sort of get this impression that he came from this godly home. I don't know why you'd say that. It's a typical home, where it was Christian in its typical sense. So yet we have Moody raised in a Christian family, quote, quote, but to what extent were these doctrines of biblical Christianity understood or developed? Assuming the best. So we have a couple of possibilities to explain this Unitarian thing. Unitarianism was making its presence felt in the early 1800s by Channing of Boston. It is possible that the distinctions of Unitarianism were not easily understood as it is not in our day. Now, I remember in our church here, when Gil was here, I remember that in the early days of our church, an article appeared in the Mennonite Conference called Christian Leader magazine that advocated Unitarianism, and no one within eyeshot or bullet shot or anywhere believed this, but it was in this magazine. Of course, Gill objected. And it was this, now I got this modalistic monarchianism. It's modal, kind, monarch, mono, one. Archianism would be authority. So we have modes, one, authority. So we have that in this word, kind of like a German word is like a sentence. So we have Christ appearing as the Son, Christ appearing as the Father, Christ appearing as the Spirit, one person. That's modalistic monarchianism. All right, this guy writes like that. I'm saying that just as an example. So we think we got it all straightened out, but an article like that appears in one of our voices. And I say, well, the editor should have stopped that. And, of course, there was a little bit rub over that. He said he didn't like it either, but he ran it because you could hear both sides, even the heretical minority of one was heard. So all I'm saying is we think that we got Unitarianism straightened out and we know exactly how it is, but that would not necessarily have been so early in the days, because even some of the people like Isaac Newton, I think he's the right guy, there are some ideas that he was Unitarian. So, you know, I guess give these guys a little bit of break on this until we get to glory, and then you can ask the questions then. Okay, while we are paused here, there's another anomaly of the D.L. Moody written by his son. His biography, introduction page written by John R. Rice, only Pete knows who he is, we will meet him later, Rice quotes Reuben Torrey, which is the closest associate of Moody, quote Torrey's statement praising Charles Finney. Get this, praising Charles Finney as one whom God had used like Moody and as he had Martin Luther. And we know a little bit about Finney now. He denied the deity of Christ, the necessary for atonement, all that kind of stuff. That was Finney. And here we are a Tory giving him this praise. And we say, how can this be? So I have somewhat of an answer. Perhaps Tory's comment on Charles Finley is informing us how unknown Finley's heretical positions on doctrine were. And I do think that's true, because I did not know Finney in his doctrine until I read somebody's expose on him and he'd taken it apart. I did not know that was within the last year. So it's possible that with Finney's popularity, the people didn't look under the hood to see what he really believed. And maybe Finney wasn't about to tell everybody what he believed, like this Tom Huxtable said to Gill one time, I don't want to tell you what I believe and you blab it all over Lincoln. So these guys that are heretics don't want people to know they're heretics, so they don't always say everything. So I'm going to give that to Tori, because I don't doubt Tori's sincerity, Moody's best friend, teacher at Moody Bible Institute, and eventually dean at the Biola Institute of Los Angeles, Bible Institute of Los Angeles, which we call now Biola. All right, maybe that wasn't worth the trip. So after some time, Moody's Christianity was obviously just religious without any regeneration work of the Spirit. Teacher Kimball, his central teacher, realized this and made a point to visit Moody. So apparently we have evangelical teaching going on in this church. Determined to see him at work, he nearly deterred passing the store. Didn't want to go in and bother, you know, embarrass him. But he found himself in the rear with Moody when he was wrapping shoes for shipment. And Kimball says that he made a weak appeal about Christ's love for him and that Christ wanted it returned. And that was it. That's all that was said, son William says. But it seemed the young man was just ready for the light that then broke up on him. And there in the back of the store in Boston, he gave him and his life to Christ. Now, we talked about this in my study this morning. Sometimes we think that to bring someone to Christ, you've got to have the whole explanation from the creation to, you know, the millennial kingdom in order for you to witness effectively. Not necessarily. I would say whatever you can say in your spot, say it. If you can, start in the beginning. If you don't have to. And this guy, of course, part of it was he was sat in the Sunday class for months, probably. So it was just a matter of are you going to believe it or not kind of question. And apparently that's how it came across to Moody. But at least the Lord used that witness, which the guy himself, Mr. Kirk said himself, was a weak witness. But the Lord used it, and he was surprised that it happened. So in other words, say whatever you can say, whenever you can say it, as much as you can say it, all right? So Moody, I remember that morning. This is Moody now speak. I just wanted to read this for you because somehow you might identify with this. I remember that morning on which I came out of my room after I had first trusted Christ. I thought the sun shone a great deal brighter than it had ever before. I thought it was just it was smiling up on me. I thought it was just smiling on me. And as I walked up on the Boston Common and heard the birds singing in the trees, I thought they were singing a song to me. Do you know I fell in love with the birds? I never cared for them before. It seemed to me that I was in love with all creation. I had not a bitter feeling against any man. I was ready to take all men into my heart. I just thought that was kind of a great expression of his faith. Now, while Moody's kind of conversion based on his changed outlook seemed genuine, it was not as apparent to those who examined it for church membership. Having muffed the question about what has Christ done for you, Moody replied, "Well, I think he's done a great deal for all of us, but I don't know of anything he's done in particular." Now, I can see that question answered that way. So it took a second examination before he was admitted to membership. Now, you know, sometimes you get a question like that asked of you, and you don't know what they're asking for you. You may be saying, "Well, what did he do for you today, like provide you a meal?" Or no, we're talking about basic things. Oh, then I understand. So I think he probably misunderstood that. But anyway, the church was tight enough, they wouldn't let him in until he was reexamined for a second interview. Okay, well, maybe I should stop there because now we're going to go into Chicago. You know, I always think of Moody in Chicago. And it was only on our trip, I guess, to the East Coast on our Heritage Tour that it struck me that Moody was from the East Coast. He's a Massachusetts boy. And so we get all the story put together, how come you end up in Chicago. But so now we're going to follow him to Chicago. And that's kind of not where he has his ministry, but that's how we know him, because of the Moody Bible Institute. But he did a lot of work back in Massachusetts, and we'll show you pictures of that. Okay, so that's slide 62. We got that far. I'll try to remember that for next week, not bore you with the same stuff. So we have a lot of things to talk about, lots of things to talk about that are going on behind the scenes over here. Some things that are really, really exciting because millenarianism, or the way we look at premillennialism, is coming on strong, and it's, you know, because it's challenged. And other things that really are going to be exciting. New churches are going to be started, new schools are started, and the evangelicals will have the world by the tail, but they don't know it, and they get really depressed later on. So it's an interesting period.